tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Ted Midward. You are tuned in here to RadioAryan.com, and we are continuing on with our series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. This is part 40. We've got maybe 30 pages to go, which is another two or three episodes, including this one. So we're rapidly approaching the end here, folks. The first half of today's episode is going to start with the first article titled, America's Jewish Enigma, Lewis Marshall. Something of an enigma is Lewis Marshall, whose name heads the list of organized Jewry in America, and who is known as the arch protester against most things non-Jewish. He is head of nearly every Jewish movement that amounts to anything, and he is chief opponent of practically every non-Jewish movement that promises to amount to something. Yet he is known mostly as a name, and not a very Jewish name at that. It would be interesting to know how the name of Marshall found its way to this Jewish gentleman. It's not a common name, even among Jews who change their names. Lewis Marshall is only Marshall listed in the Jewish Encyclopedia, and the only Jewish Marshall in the index of the publications of the American Jewish Historical Society. In the list of the annual contributors to the American Jewish Committee are to be found such names as Marschitz, Mayer, Massel, Mermort, Mannheimer, Marx, Morse, Mackler, Marcus, Morris, Moskowitz, Marx, Margolis, Merrick, but only one Marshall, and that is Lewis. Of any other prominent Jew, it may be asked, which Strauss, which Untermeyer, which Kahn, which Schiff, but never which Marshall, for there is only one. This in itself would indicate that Marshall is not a Jewish name. It is an American or Anglo-Saxon name transplanted into a Jewish family. But how and why are questions to which the public as yet have no answer. Lewis Marshall is head of the American Jewish Committee, and the American Jewish Committee is head of all official Jewish activity in the United States. As head of the committee, he is also head of the Executive Committee of the New York Kehillah, an organization which is the active front of organized Jewry in New York, and the center of Jewish propaganda for the United States. The nominal head of the Kehillah is Rabbi Judah L. Magnus, a brother-in-law of Lewis Marshall. Not only are the American Jewish Committee and the Kehillah linked officially, but they are also linked domestically as well. Lewis Marshall was president of all the Jewish committees of the world at the Versailles Peace Conference, and it is charged now, as it has been charged before, that the Jewish program is the only program that went through the Versailles Peace Conference as it was drawn, and the so-called League of Nations is busily carrying out its terms today. A determined effort is being made by Jews to have the Washington Conference take up the same matter. Colonel House was Lewis Marshall's chief aide at Paris, enforcing the Jewish program on an unwilling world. Lewis Marshall has appeared in all the great Jewish cases. The impeachment of Governor Sulzer was a piece of Jewish revenge, but Lewis Marshall was Sulzer's attorney. Sulzer was removed from the office of governor. The case of Leo Frank, a Jew charged with the peculiarly vicious murder of a Georgia factory girl, was defended by Mr. Marshall. It was one of those cases where the whole world is whipped into excitement because a Jew is in trouble. It is almost an indication of the racial character of a culprit these days to note how much money is spent for him and how much fuss is raised concerning him. It seems to be a part of Jewish loyalty to prevent, if possible, the Gentile law being enforced against Jews. The Dreyfus case and the Frank case are examples of the endless publicity the Jews secure in behalf of their own people. Frank was reprieved from the death sentence and sent to prison, after which he was killed. That horrible act can be traced directly to the state of public opinion, which was caused by raucous Jewish publicity which stopped at nothing to attain its ends. To this day, the state of Georgia is, in the average mind, part of an association of ideas directly traceable to this Jewish propaganda. Jewish publicity did to Georgia what it did to Russia, grossly misrepresented it, and so ceaselessly as to create a false impression generally. It is not without reason that the Ku Klux Klan was revived in Georgia and that Jews were excluded from membership. Lewis Marshall is chairman of the board and of the executive committee of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, whose principal theologian, Mordecai M. Kaplan, is the leading exponent of an educational plan by which Judaism can be made to supersede Christianity in the U.S. Under cover of synagogal activities, which he knows that the well-known tolerance of the American people will never suspect, Rabbi Kaplan has thought out and systemized and launched a program to that end, certainly not without the approval of Mr. Marshall. Lewis Marshall is not the world leader of Jewry, but he is well advanced in Jewry's world council, as is seen by the fact that International Jewry reports to him, and also by the fact that he headed the Jews at the Kosher Conference, as the Versailles assemblage was known among those on the inside. Strange things happened in Paris. Mr. Marshall and Colonel House had affairs very well in hand between them. President Wilson sent a delegation to Syria to find out just what the contention of the Syrians was against the Jews, but that report has never seen the light of day. But it was the easiest thing imaginable to keep the president informed as to what the Jews of New York thought, that is, the few who had not taken up residence in Paris. For example, this prominent dispatch in the New York Times of May 27, 1919 reads as follows. Wilson gets full report of Jewish protest here. Copyright 1919 by the New York Times Company. By wireless to the New York Times. Paris, May 26th. Lewis Marshall, who has succeeded Judge Mack as head of the Jewish Committee in Paris, was received by President Wilson this afternoon and gave a long cabled account of the Jewish mass meeting recently held in Madison Square Garden, including the full text of the resolutions adopted at the meeting, and editorial comment in the Times and other papers. When Russia fell, Lewis Marshall hailed it with delight. The New York Times begins its story on March 19, 1917. Hailing the Russian upheaval as the greatest world event since the French Revolution, Lewis Marshall, in an interview for the New York Times last night, said a number of things, among which was the statement that the events in Russia were no surprise. Of course they were not, the events being of Jewish origin, and Mr. Marshall being the recipient of the most intimate international news. Even the new Russian Revolutionary Government made reports to Lewis Marshall, as is shown by the dispatch printed in the New York Times of April 3, 1917, in which Baron Gunzburg reports what had been done to assure to the Jews the full advantage of the Russian upheaval. This glorification of the Jewish overthrow of Russia, it must be remembered, occurred before the world knew what Bolshevism was, and before it realized that the revolution meant the withdrawal of the whole Eastern Front from the war. Russia was simply taken out of the war, and the Central Powers left free to devote their whole attention to the Western Front. One of the resulting necessities was the immediate entrance of America into the conflict, and the prolongation of the hostilities for nearly two more years. As the truth became known, Lewis Marshall first defended, then explained, and then denied, his latest position being that the Jews are against Bolshevism. He was brought to this position by the necessity of meeting the testimony of eyewitnesses as given to congressional investigation committees. This testimony came from responsible men whom even Mr. Marshall could not dispose of with a wave of his hand, and as time has gone on, the testimony has increased to mountainous proportions that Bolshevism is Jewish in its origin, its method, its personnel, and its purpose. Herman Bernstein, a member of Mr. Marshall's American Jewish Committee, has lately been preparing American public opinion for a great anti-Semitic movement in Russia. Certainly it will be an anti-Semitic movement because it will be anti-Bolshevist, and the Russian people, having lived with the hybrid for 5 years, are not mistaken as to its identity. During the war, Mr. Marshall was the arch protester. While Mr. Baruch was running the war from the business end, remember his famous quote in an earlier episode, "I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless that is true." Mr. Marshall was running another side. We find him protesting because an army officer gave him instructions as to his duties as a registration official. It was Mr. Marshall who complained to the Secretary of War that a certain camp contractor, after trying out carpenters, had advertised for Christian carpenters only. It was to the discrimination in print that Mr. Marshall chiefly objected. It may be surmised, since it is the policy of his committee to make it impossible, or at least unhealthy, to use print to call attention to the Jew. It was Mr. Marshall who compelled a change in the instructions sent out by the Provost Marshal General of the United States Army to the effect that foreign-born, especially Jews, are more apt to malinger than the native-born. It is said that a Jewish medical officer afterward confirmed this part of the instruction, saying that experience proved it. Nevertheless, President Wilson ordered that the paragraph be cut out. It was Mr. Marshall who compelled the revision of the Plattsburgh Officer's Training Manual. That valuable book rightly said that the ideal officer is a Christian gentleman. Mr. Marshall wrote, wired, demanded, and the edition was changed. It now reads that the ideal officer is a courteous gentleman. A big drop in idealism. There was nothing too unimportant to draw forth Mr. Marshall's protest. To take care of protests alone, he must have a large organization. And yet, with all this high-tension, pro-Jewish activity, Mr. Marshall is not a self-advertising man, as is his law partner, Samuel Untermyer, who has been referred to as the arch-inquisitor against the Gentiles. Marshall is a name, a power, not so much a public figure. As an informed Jew said about the two men, "No, Marshall doesn't advertise himself like Sam, and he has never tried to feature himself in the newspapers for personal reasons. Outside of his professional life, he devotes himself exclusively to religious affairs." That is the way the American Jew likes to describe the activities referred to above, as religious affairs. We shall soon see that they are political affairs. Mr. Marshall is short, stocky, and aggressive. Like his brother-in-law, Rabbi Magnus, he works on the principle that the Jew can do no wrong. For many years, Mr. Marshall has lived in a four-story brownstone house of the old-fashioned type, with a grilled door, in East 72nd Street. This is an old-time swell neighborhood, once almost wholly occupied by wealthy Jews. It was as close as they could crowd to the choice Fifth Avenue corners, which had been preempted by the Vanderbilts, the Astors, and other rich families. That Mr. Marshall regards the whole Jewish program in which he is engaged, not in its religious aspect alone, but in its worldwide political aspect, may be judged from his attitude on Zionism. Mr. Marshall wrote in 1918 as follows, "I have never been identified and am not now in any way connected with the Zionist organization. I have never favored the creation of a sovereign Jewish state. But," Mr. Marshall says, "let the Zionists go on. Don't interfere with them." Why? He writes this, "Zionism is but an incident of a far-reaching plan. It is merely a convenient peg on which to hang a powerful weapon. All the protests that non-Zionists may make would be futile to affect that policy." He says that opposition to Zionism at that time would be dangerous. "I could give concrete examples of a most impressive nature in support of what I have said. I am not an alarmist, and even my enemies will give me credit for not being a coward. But my love for our people is such that even if I were disposed to combat Zionism, I would shrink from the responsibilities that might be entailed were I to do so." And in concluding this strange pronouncement, he says this, "Give me the credit of believing that I am speaking advisedly." Of course, there is more to Zionism than appears on the surface, but this is as close as anyone can come to finding a Jewish admission on the subject. If in this country there is apprehension over the Jewish problem, the activities of Lewis Marshall have been the most powerful agents to evoke it. His propagandas have occasioned great resentment in many sections of the U.S. His opposition to salutary immigration laws, his dictation to book and periodical publishers, as in the recent case of G.P. Putnam's sons, who modified their publishing program on his order, his campaign against use of Christological expressions by federal, state, and municipal officers, all have resulted in alarming the native population and harming the very cause he so indiscreetly advocates. That this defender of Jewish rights and restless advocate of the Jewish religious propaganda should make himself the leader in attacking the religion of the dominant race in this country, in ridiculing Sunday laws, and heading an anti-Christianity campaign seems, to say the least, inconsistent. Mr. Marshall, who is regarded by the Jews as their greatest constitutional lawyer since the decline of Edward Lauterbach, and that is a tale, originated in a series of legal arguments, the contention that this is not a Christian country nor a Christian government. This argument he has expounded in many writings. He has built up a large host of followers among contentious Jews who have elaborated on this theme in a variety of ways. It is one of the main arguments of those who are endeavoring to build up a united Israel in the United States. Mr. Marshall maintains that the opening of deliberative assemblies and conventions with prayer is a hollow mockery. He ridicules the absurd phrase, "In the name of God, Amen," as used in the beginning of wills. He opposes Sunday observance legislation as being the cloak of hypocrisy. He advocates crushing out every agitation which tends to introduce into the body politic the virus of religious controversy. But Mr. Marshall himself has spent the last 20 years of his life in the virus of religious controversy. A few of his more impertinent interferences have been noted above. These are, in the Jewish phrase, religious activities, with a decidedly political tinge. The following extracts are quoted from the contentions of Mr. Marshall. published in the Menorah Journal, the official organ of the Jewish Chautauqua, that the United States is not a Christian country. Is Ours a Christian Government? By Lewis Marshall. When, in 1892, Mr. Justice Brewer, in rendering the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, in the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity against the United States, which involved an interpretation of the alien labor law, indulged in the orbiter remark that, quote, "This is a Christian nation. A subject was presented for the consideration of thoughtful minds which is of no ordinary importance." The dictum of Mr. Justice Story in Vidal against Girard's executors, to the effect that Christianity was a part of the common law of Pennsylvania, is also relied upon, but is not an authoritative judicial determination of that proposition. The remark was not necessary to the decision. The remarks of Mr. Justice Brewer, to which reference has already been made, were also unnecessary to the decision rendered by the court. The fact that oaths are administered to witnesses, that the hollow mockery is pursued of opening deliberative assemblies and conventions with prayer, that wills begin with the absurd phrase, "In the name of God, Amen," that gigantic missionary associations are in operation to establish Christian missions in every quarter of the globe, were all instanced. But none of these illustrations affords any valid proof in support of the assertion that this is a Christian nation. Our legislation relative to the observance of Sunday is such a mass of absurdities and inconsistencies that almost anything can be predicated thereon except the idea that our legislators are impressed with the notion that there is anything sacred in the day. According to the views of any section of the Christian Church, the acts which I have enumerated as permitted would be regarded as sinful. Their legality in the eye of the law is a demonstration that the prohibitory enactments relating to Sunday are simply police regulations, and it should be the effort of every good American citizen to liberalize our Sunday legislation still more, so that it shall cease to be the cloak of hypocrisy. As a final resort, we are told by our opponents that this is a Christian government, because the majority of our citizens are adherents of the Christian faith, that this is a government of majorities, because government means force and majorities represent the preponderance of strength. This is a most dangerous doctrine. If the Christianity of the United States is to be questioned, the last person to initiate the inquiry should be a member of that race which had no hand in creating the Constitution or in the upbuilding of the country. If Christian prayers in public are a hollow mockery and Sunday laws unreasonable, the last person in the world to oppose them should be a Jew. Mr. Marshall has the advantage of being an American by birth. He was born in Syracuse, New York, in 1856, the son of Jacob and Zilly Marshall. After practicing law in Syracuse, he established himself in New York, became a Wall Street Corporation lawyer, and his native country has afforded him generous means to win a large fortune. The question arises whether it is patriotic for Mr. Marshall to implant into the minds of his foreign-born co-religionists the idea that this is not a Christian country, that Sunday laws should be opposed, and that the manners and customs of the native-born should be scorned and ridiculed. The effect has been that thousands of immigrant Jews from Eastern Europe are persistently violating Sunday laws in the large industrial centers of the country, that they are hailed to court, lectured by judges, and fined. American Jews who are carrying into practice the teachings of Mr. Marshall and his followers are reaping the whirlwind of a natural resentment. Mr. Marshall was the leader of the movement, which led to the abrogation of the treaty between the United States and Russia. Whenever government boards or committees are appointed to investigate the actions, conduct, or conditions of foreign-born Jews, great influences are immediately exerted to have Mr. Marshall made a member of such bodies to protect Jewish interests. As head of millions of organized Jews in the U.S., Mr. Marshall has invariably wielded this influence by means of a campaign of protests to silence criticisms of Jewish wrongdoing. He thus protested when testimony was made before the Senate Subcommittee in Washington in 1919 that the Jewish East Side of New York was the hotbed of Bolshevism. Again, he protested to Norman Hapgood against the editorial in Harper's Weekly criticizing the activities of Jewish lobbyists in Washington. Mr. Marshall describes himself in Who's Who as a leader in the fight for the abrogation of the treaty with Russia. That was a distinct interference in America's political affairs and was not a religious activity connected with the preservation of Jewish rights in the United States. The limiting expression in the United States is, of course, our own assumption. It is doubtful if Mr. Marshall limits anything to the United States. He is a Jew and therefore an internationalist. He is ambassador of the international nation of Jewry to the Gentile world. The pro-Jewish fights in which Mr. Marshall has been engaged in this country make a considerable list. He fought the proposal of the Census Bureau to enumerate Jews as a race. As a result, there are no official figures, except those prepared by the American Jewish Committee, as to the Jewish population of the U.S. The census has them listed under a score of different nationalities, which is not only a non-descriptive method, but a deceptive one as well. At a pinch, the Jewish authorities will admit of 3.5 million Jews in the United States. The increase in the amount of Passover bread required would indicate that there are 6 million in the United States now. But the government of the United States is entirely at sea, officially, as to the Jewish population of this country, except as the Jewish government in this country, as an act of courtesy, passes over certain figures to the government. The Jews have a foreign office through which they deal with the government of the United States. Mr. Marshall also fought the proposed naturalization laws that would deprive Asiatics of the privilege of becoming naturalized citizens. This was something of a confession. Wherever there were extradition cases to be fought, preventing Jewish offenders from being extradited, Mr. Marshall was frequently one who assisted. This also was part of his religious activities, perhaps. He fought the right of the United States government to restrict immigration. He has appeared oftener in Washington than any other Jew on this question. In connection with this, it may be suggested to Mr. Marshall that if he really is interested in upholding the law of the land and restraining his own people from lawless acts, he could busy himself with profitable results if he would look into the smuggling of Jews across the Mexican and Canadian borders. And when that service is finished, he might look into the national Jewish system of bootlegging, which, as a Jew of religious activities, he should be concerned to break up. Lewis Marshall is leader of that movement which will force the Jew, by law, into places where he is not wanted. The law, compelling hotel keepers to permit Jews to make their hotels a place of resort if they want to, has been steadily pushed. Such a law is practically a Bolshevik order to destroy property, for it is commonly known what Jewish patronage does for public places. Where a few respectable Jews are permitted, others flock. And when one day they discover that the place they patronize is becoming known as a Jew hotel or a Jew club, then all the Jews abandon it. But they cannot take the stigma with them. The place is known as a Jew place, but lacks both Jew and Gentile patronage as a result. When Louis Marshall succeeded in compelling, by Jewish pressure and Jewish threats, the Congress of the United States to break the treaty with Russia, he was laying a train of causes which resulted in a prolongation of the war and the utter subjugation of Russia. Russia serves the world today as a living illustration of the ruthlessness, the stupidity, and the reality of Jewish power. Endless power, fanatically mobilized for a vengeful end, but most stupidly administered. Does Mr. Marshall ever reflect on the grotesque stupidity of Jewish leadership? It is regretted that space does not permit the publication here of the correspondence between Mr. Marshall and Major G. H. Putnam, the publisher, as set forth in the annual report of the American Jewish Committee. It illustrates quite vividly the methods by which Mr. Marshall secures the suppression of books and other publications which he does not like. Mr. Marshall, assisted by factors which are not mentioned in his letter, procured the suppression of the protocols after the House of Putnam had them ready to publish, and procured later the withdrawal of a book on the Jewish question which had attracted wide attention both here and in England. Mr. Marshall apparently has no confidence in absurdities appearing absurd to the reader, nor of lies appearing false. But he would constitute himself a censor and a guide of public reading, as well as of international legislation. If one might hazard a guess, Mr. Marshall's kind of leadership is on the wane. That's the end of this article. This was published November 26, 1921 in the Dearborn Independent. So there you have it. In addition to Colonel Edward Mandel House and others, I suppose the lesson here is don't forget about Louis Marshall. And it's certainly important to note, he is not someone who is really on my radar for this period of time, but perhaps we can jump into more about the history of Louis Marshall on some future independent broadcasts. I will make a note of that. Okay, that's the end of the first half of this week's episode. Let's move on to the second half. This is an article entitled The Economic Plans of International Jews. And at the top, we have notes here. James Russell Lowell always declared that he was of Jewish extraction and proud of his ancestry. If anybody has achieved an exceptionally high grade in a difficult course, he or she was probably Jewish. That's from the Syracuse Jewish Monthly publication. The Economic Plans of International Jews. The strength of Jewish money is in its internationalism. It stretches a chain of banks and centers of financial control across the world and plays them on the side of the game that favors Judah, or the Jews here. This center was, and for the moment is, in Germany, at Frankfurt on the Main. But feverish anxiety now accompanies the fear that it may have to be moved. Destiny is overtaking the Jewish world power. The gold which is their god, the god of the living, is what they call their gold, is being brought overseas on every available ship and locked up in the vaults of Jewish bankers in North and South America, not to enrich this hemisphere, but to mobilize Jewish financial power for any desperate stroke. Financial Jewry is afraid. It has a right to be afraid. Its conscience, still bloody from the war whose gains have not yet stopped, is in a troubled state. Single Jewish banking houses in any country, however great such banks should grow, would be no menace. In spite of the fact that the richest bankers in the world are Jews, as mere bankers in their several countries, they would not occasion alarm. In straight, out-and-out banking, the Jew is not a success. The Rothschilds were never bankers in a proper sense, They were money lenders to nations whose representatives had corrupted to seek the loans. They did business precisely on the plane of the money lender in the side street, who induces the rich man's son to borrow a large sum, knowing that the father will pay. That is scarcely banking. Brains of that sort may get money, but will not make money. The deposit banking of the world is not done in Jewish banks anyway, even Jewish depositors preferring banks which are managed by non-Jews. It is not, therefore, the success of the individual Jewish banking house that concerns us. Flabby-minded non-Jews who have been blinded by pro-Jewish propaganda find difficulty in seeing that point. They say that the individual Jewish businessman has as much right to his business success as has anyone else. Which is a perfect Jewish platitude. Certainly he has. Whoever stated that he had not? But when you were dealing with a world chain of financial consulates, all of them linking up in a world system, none of them to be regarded as American banks, or British banks, or French banks, or Italian banks, or German banks, but all of them members of the Jewish world banking system, you're obviously not dealing with individuals who are trying to make a living. You're then dealing with a mighty force, for good or ill, and thus far, sad truth to know, the ill is mountainous in comparison. Nor does this Jewish banking system require that in each country, a Jewish house be the most important. It is not the wealth and importance of single houses, but the wealth and importance of the world chain that gives the strength. Kuhn, Loeb & Company is far from being the most important financial house in the United States, but with its foreign connections, all Jewish, it takes on a new aspect. Kuhn, Loeb & Company is far from being the most important banking house in the U.S., and yet it was an idea that came out of Kuhn, Loeb & Company's office that now dominates the monetary system of the U.S. Paul Warburg, a German Jew, scion of the Jewish World Banking Group, is boosted into undue prominence and power through the pressure of banker-bought prestige in government circles. It is his connections, Jewish ones, that count. The Warburg idea in the United States, dovetailing with the Stearns, the Furstenbergs, the Sonnensteins, and the Sassoons and Samuels, and Bleichroders overseas, was something to wonder at. Jewish bankers ran this war as they have run every great war. No informed Jew will deny that. Most informed Jews have boasted of it as indicating the importance of their people. Above the nations at war was an international financial committee, all Jewish, looking down upon all the ruction and blood as serenely as American Baseball League directors look down upon a pennant series. Separated, each man tied to his country by ties of undivided nationalistic loyalty, none of these would have amounted to much. United, as a supranational financial board, knowing the secrets of all the nations, conferring one with another in all sorts of ways, even during the hardest days when all communication between countries was supposed to be locked by war, deciding the duration of the war and the hour of so-called peace, these groups constitute a danger which no one doubts after once having seen it clearly. Men who can thus manipulate money in time of war can do so in time of peace. The United States is living under some of that peace manipulation now. The reader of the protocols is much impressed by the financial notes that are sounded throughout their proposals. The Jewish defense against the protocols, that they were written by a criminal or a madman, is intended only for those who have not read the protocols or who have overlooked the financial plans they offer. Madmen and criminals do not coolly dissect one money system and invent another, as do the protocolists. Let me stop and comment. I have urged listeners to read the protocols on their own as part of homework for this series to better understand where Henry and his editors are coming from. And I think it's fair to say, I've thought this myself in the past, once you read the protocols, you realize this isn't the work of some madman or criminal or someone trying to frame the Jews. Whoever wrote these ought to take credit because they're an absolute genius with how devious and diabolical and criminal they are in laying out their plans. This wasn't some nutcase drug addict, you know, slobbering on himself in a back alley somewhere who decided one day to malign the Jews for no reason that wrote the protocols. Someone with a very sharp, shrewd mind wrote the protocols. Continuing on. Back to the text. It will be worthwhile, in view of the sidelights that these articles have thrown on the money question, to recall some of the forecasts and plans made in these most remarkable documents which have been attributed to the wise men of Zion, the world leaders of the Inner Council. When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. When we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse. So wrote the great Jewish Zionist leader Theodor Herzl in his work A Jewish State, and that line is from page 23 of that original publication. It is precisely that union of revolutionary tendencies and financial power that the world is facing now. Look at Russia, and look at the people who swarmed at Versailles and made the peace treaty. The peace treaty was written by financiers. It is the bill presented, not to a beaten foe, but to the world. Very few people have ever read it, but its operation is evident everywhere. The Jewish bankers the world over are shoveling in the gold. Protocol number 6 is interesting in this connection. Quote, "We shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth, upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall, together with the government credit, on the day following the political catastrophe." End quote. Although these words were written with Europe in view, the United States not having yet been Judaized, their import is clear. At the present moment, the number of business concerns in the hands of Jewish creditors through loans is very large. The Jewish idea in business is to borrow instead of making the business stand on its own two feet. The trail of that idea is seen all over our land today. At the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise of industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private wealth to increase and tend to improve the position of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land, both of laborers and capital, and, through speculation, transfer all the money in the world into our hands. To destroy Gentile industry, we shall, as an incentive to this speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries. There's the idea. Extravagance and debt support the Jewish money lender's power. He does not lend to build industry, but to drain it. Independent industrial or agricultural wealth menaces his rule. Industry must be curbed by speculation. Speculation must be encouraged by extravagance. An industrious people soon works itself free of its debt slavery. Therefore, invent new excitements to keep it in debt. Entice people from the farms, and so forth, all which devices are now well known to the world. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in the price of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol. That wages were forced up, that they were of little profit to the workers, that prices did rise, that the above excuses were given, that anarchistic ideas are now being circulated among the workers, are Jewish and circulated by Jews, that the illicit liquor business, as once was the legal liquor business, is entirely in the hands of Jews, these things everyone knows to be true. The protocols have been in non-Jewish knowledge since 1896. The British Museum has possessed a copy since 1906. Were they written by a prophet who foresaw or by a power that foreordained? The Jewish World Program is shown in these protocols to be largely dependent on the false economic ideas it can induce the governments and peoples to accept. The false economic ideas, not only false, but cruelly deceptive and impossible, which are being sown among the masses of the people, are the counterpart of the other false economic propaganda being sown in the upper circles of banking and government. Jewish economic ideas are quite different from the ones which Jewish thinkers put out for others to follow. Jewish bankers know better than anyone else the utter falsity of the present system, but they profit by that falsity, and they are ruining non-Jewish rule by that falsity, and they are establishing Judah by that falsity, or the Jews as large, probably be more accurate, and they will try to maintain that falsity until it brings the inevitable collapse. After which they hope to reorganize the world on Jewish monetary principles. So at least the protocols indicate. This bad regime is for the so-called Gentile period only. The temporary nature of the present Jewish system and the destruction it is meant to work in the world is shown in the third protocol, where, after discussing ways and means to make the lower classes hate the well-to-do, it says this: "This hostility will be still more accentuated as the results of crises which will close stock exchange operations and stop the wheels of industry. Having organized such a general economic crisis by all the underground means available to us, and thanks to the assistance of gold, all of which is in our hands, we will throw whole crowds of working men into the streets simultaneously in all the countries of Europe. These crowds will gladly shed the blood of those whom they, in the simplicity of their ignorance, have envied since childhood and whose property they will then be able to loot." All this, as the world knows, has occurred in Europe. The weapons first used were economic. The subjection of the people, the revolution, was first economic. The Jewish program profited by the split which Jewish ideas had been able to make between the upper and lower classes of Gentile society. Divide and rule is the Jewish motto, as quoted in the protocols. Divide the working class from the directing class. Divide the Catholic and Protestant churches. In brief, divide Christendom on economic, creedal, social, and racial lines, while the Jew remains a solid body, able because of his solidarity to handle a divided world. All this plan has succeeded. Out of the disorder of the World War, look how high the government of the Jews has been placed in Russia, Austria, Germany, France, Italy, England, and in the United States. All the Jewish bankers are still in Russia. It was only the non-Jewish bankers who were shot and their property confiscated. Bolshevism has not abolished capital. It has only stolen the capital of the Gentiles. And that is all that Jewish socialism or anarchism or Bolshevism is designed to do. Every banker who is caricatured with dollar marks on his clothes is a Gentile banker. Every capitalist publicly denounced in red parades is a Gentile capitalist. Every big strike, railroad, steel, coal, is against Gentile industry. That is the purpose of the Red Movement. It is alien, Jewish, and anti-Christian. Now, one of the interesting points about the Jewish financial scheme for the future, as shown in the protocols, is the way in which it contrasts with the financial scheme which the Jewish groups now favor. As before stated, what the protocolists now advise is not what they will adopt when their present advice has worked its hoped-for results. The protocols which detail the future financial plan of Jewish control are numbered 20 and 21. Protocol 20 opens thus with saying, "Today we will speak of the financial program, the discussion of which I have postponed to the close of my report, as it is the most difficult, decisive, and concrete of our plans." End quote. Throughout the recital, the protocolist harks back to the old, our present, financial system, and some of his remarks are worth transcribing here. Quote, "You know that the gold standard destroyed the governments that accepted it, for it could not satisfy the demand for currency, especially as we removed as much gold as possible from circulation." End quote. Whether the first statement is true remains to be seen. The others are demonstrably true. The gold in the ground and the gold that is money is under Jewish control, and they withdraw it when they will. The stupid so-called Gentile says, "Why should they withdraw it? They cannot make any money that way." Once again, remember the distinction. It is not a matter of making money, but of getting it. Panics are more quickly profitable than is a long period of prosperity for men whose commodity is money. Indeed, men who deal in money as a commodity and on the Jewish plan lose their prestige if prosperity continues too long. The banker who is a banker, who lives to serve industry and the community, he profits by prosperity, but not so the money sharks. Here's another quote from the protocols. "We created economic crises for the Gentiles by the withdrawal of money from circulation. Mass capital stagnated. Money was withdrawn from use by the various governments, and they in turn were obliged to turn back to the capitalists for loans. Such loans naturally embarrassed the governments owing to the payment of interest charges and made them subservient to the capitalists." The withdrawal of money from circulation will create panics. Everyone knows that. Such withdrawal of money is within the decision of a very small group of men. Here in the United States, we have been for a long 15 months witnessing such a withdrawal and its effects. The word went by wire across the land, setting a date. On that date, values began to crash all over the country, and honest bankers tried to help, while others who knew the game profited hugely. As shown in the last article, money was withdrawn from legitimate use, that it might be lent to money speculators at 6%, who in turn lent it to desperate people at rates as high as 30%. No intelligent person will attempt to explain such events on the ground of natural law or of honest practice. These things occurred in this country within recent days. It is the elastic system, you know, with the public as a monkey on one end of the elastic. A splendid idea, no doubt, if administered by the non-Jewish method of doing the greatest possible good to the greatest number, but a deliberate assassination of life and property as it has been administered. The protocolists then pay their respects to the governmental finance with the keenness that is well justified. Quote, owing to methods allowed by irresponsible Gentile governments, their treasuries became empty. Then came the period of contracting loans and using up the assets that remained. This brought all the Gentile governments to bankruptcy. End quote. As operating groups, the governments are now bankrupt. Only their power of confiscation keeps them up. The United States, commonly referred to as the richest country in the world, is just as poor as a government as any other. It has nothing. It is in debt and is borrowing. And its creditors are constantly discounting their obligations and putting it into worse hands than ever. Even the Liberty Bonds are almost passed out of the hands of the people into the hands of Jewish fiscal agents who get money out of the necessities of the people who sell and out of the necessities of the government which borrowed. And if all signs do not fail, we shall one day be hearing in Congress for pleas for special legislation in behalf of the old poor bondholders. It is to be hoped when that day comes, someone will have mettle enough to stand up and declare who the poor bondholders are. A list should be made now for future reference. Here's another excerpt from the protocols. Every loan proves government inefficiency and ignorance of governmental rights. Loans, like the sword of Damocles, hangs above the heads of the rulers, who, instead of placing temporary taxes on their subjects, stretch forth their hands and beg for charity at the hands of our bankers. Essentially, foreign loans are leeches, which in no instance can be removed from the government body until they fall off of their own accord or the government itself removes them. But Gentile governments, instead of removing them, continue to place more. They must perish inevitably through exhaustion by voluntary bloodletting. Back to the text. This is the plainly expressed criticism of the Jewish world government upon the governments of the nations, and the truth of it cannot be gainsaid. It represents a statement of common wisdom upon which the Jewish world program hopes to commend itself to the common people. Then why do not the Jewish world financiers help the nations out of this false financial policy? It can be commonly heard said. Why, indeed, Jewish financiers are the inventors of such loans, as they here describe, the barriers to such direct taxes, as they here recommend. Listen, in the same page as above, quote, "You may well understand that such a policy, although inspired by us, cannot be followed by us." End quote. That is historically true, whether it will prove prophetically true or not. Compromising loans and interest are Jewish devices, historically Jewish. Practically and at present, the Jew prefers not to borrow and accept such a way as to place all business risks on other people's money while he keeps his own safely, and the payment of interest is an abomination to him. These statements of the protocols have at least these historical and racial confirmations. The whole stupidity of the Gentile system by which Jewish international financiers are enriched is clearly set forth in the same 20th protocol. Quote, "What is the effect of a loan, especially a foreign loan, other than this? A loan is the issuance of government notes, pledging interest in proportion to the sum of borrowed capital. If the loan pays 5%, then in 20 years the government has paid the interest in vain, for it is equal to the sum of the loan. In 40 years it is paid out in amount equal to the loan twice over, and in 60 years, three times, while the original debt remains unpaid." This is extremely simple, and yet it is the most generally ignored fact of all. We live in a democracy, yet loans are contracted that always cost more than the amount of the loan, and no one has a word to say about it. We Americans do not know how much interest we pay every year, and we don't know to whom we pay it. We are still living under the lie that A national debt is a national blessing, the most delusive doctrine ever promulgated. The amount of our national debt is the measure of our enslavement to Jewish world finance. The reader may observe in passing that Jewish apologists like John Spargo, Herman Bernstein, and others say that the protocols were put out by the secret police of the Russian Tsarist regime. It is very unusual, is it not, to find the Tsar's police interested in the plans to remove graft from high finance and preaching doctrines exactly contrary to the established system. The reader will find some amusement in searching for the Russian police spies in the further development of the Jewish financial philosophy. The purposes of Protocols 20 and 21 is not to describe the present financial chaos in which the Gentiles are encouraged to continue. That system was described in the previous protocols. Their purpose is rather to describe how the Jewish world power plans to run things when the time comes. This is well worth considering, for there are portions of the plan which would be worth adopting. The Jewish expectation of world rule is, of course, absurd, although the mass of Jews sincerely hold it. Their condemnation is that they regard every degeneracy in society as bringing them a step nearer their goal, which explains the great assistance they give to all degenerative processes. Here's a quote. When we ascend the thrones of the world, such financial expediencies, not being in accord with our interest, will be definitely eliminated. That is the opening note. It's another version of the statement, you may well understand that such a policy, although inspired by us, cannot be followed by us. What, then, did the protocolists, looking for world power, propose to eliminate? And here we have a list of things that they wish to eliminate. Number one, the stock exchanges will be permanently suppressed, for we will not allow the prestige of our authority to be shaken by price fluctuations on our stocks. We will fix the full value legally without permitting any power to raise or lower it. Raising prices gives the pretext for lowering them, which was what we started with the stocks and bonds of the Gentiles. Number two, the lawful confiscation of money in order to regulate its circulation. Number three, we must introduce a unit of exchange based on the value of labor units, regardless of whether paper or wood are used as the medium. We will issue money to meet the normal demands of every subject citizen, adding to a total sum for every birth and decreasing the total amount for every death. That's interesting. I'm not going to comment. I could, but we're moving on. Number four, commercial paper will be bought by the government, which, instead of paying tribute on loans as at present, will grant loans on a business basis. A measure of this character will prevent the stagnation of money, parasitism, and laziness, qualities which were useful to us as long as the Gentiles maintained their independence, but which are not desirable to us when our kingdom comes. Number five, we will replace stock exchanges by great government credit institutions, whose functions will be to tax trade paper according to government regulations. These institutions will be in such a position that they may market or buy as many as 500 million industrial shares a day. The reader will bear in mind that the police spies of agricultural Russia forged this document in 1896. As a gentleman remarked, if this is a forgery, what must have been the original? That's an author's note here. Continuing on with point number five, thus all industrial undertakings will become dependent on us. You may well imagine what power that will give us. The protocolist now being quoted also gives his attention to taxation. Observe again the Russian police spy doing some forging here. The builders of this plan for world rule recognize that when the overturn comes, they will have to be in a position to offer the people something extremely good in order to win their favor. This, of course, was the plan in Russia, although Russia presents no parallel to what the protocolists hoped to do for what they call their kingdom. Russia was simply tortured in punishment. Russia was a Passover offering. Russia is an example of Jewish vengeance, destruction, rage, not of the rule which international Jewry hopes to put over a world economically conquered through its own weakness and lust. Here, then, the taxation plan is follows. Point number one. When we become rulers, our autocratic government, as a first principle of self-protection, will avoid burdening the people with heavy taxes. It must not forget to play the part of father and protector. But as government organizations are costly, it is necessary to raise money for maintenance. Consequently, it is necessary to study carefully, in this particular, the problem of checks and balances. Number two, the kinds of taxes to be raised. Point A, the best method of taxation is to establish a progressive tax on property. And B, the receipt of purchased money or an inheritance will be subjected to a progressive stamp tax. Point C, any transfer of personal property, whether in money or other form of value. And D, a luxury tax. The latter will be taxed through the medium of a stamp impost. The rich are to be taxed in proportion to their wealth. A tax on a poor man is the seed of revolution, and it is detrimental to the government which loses the big things in its pursuit of the small. But there are other shrewd reasons for thus taxing the rich. Point A, aside from this, the tax on capitalists will lessen the growth of wealth in private hands, where we have concentrated it at present as a counterweight to the government power of the Gentiles. And point B, such a measure will destroy the hatred of the poor toward the rich, who will be regarded as the financial support of the government and the exponents of peace and prosperity. The poor will realize that the rich are paying the money necessary to attain these things. This was written at least as early as 1896. How many forms of taxation have come precisely as here outlined? How illuminating also the following remark, quote, money should circulate, and to hinder free circulation has a fatal effect upon the government mechanism which it lubricates. That thickening of the lubricator may stop the correct functioning of the whole machine. The substitution of a part of money exchange by discount paper has created just such an impediment. End quote. Remember that when next you hear the Jewish plan that Gentiles shall do business with their own bits of paper while the Jews keep the gold reserve safely in their own hands. If a crash comes, Gentiles have the paper and the Jews have the gold. Lahaim. If bits of paper serve ordinarily, the world may sometime decide to do away with the gold. Certainly a system which rests on cash yet works with non-cash has disadvantages which depression and panic reveal. Says Protocol 22, quote, we hold in our hands the greatest modern power, gold. In 2 days, we could free it from our treasuries in any desired quantities. The Jews are economists, esoteric and exoteric. They have one system to tangle up the Gentiles, another they hope to install when Gentile stupidity has bankrupted the world. The Jews are economists. Note the number of them who teach economics in the state universities. Here's a quote from Protocol Number 8. We will surround our government with a whole world of economists. It is for this reason that the science of economics is the chief subject of instruction taught by the Jews. End quote. That's the end of the second half of today's episode. This article was published July 23rd, 1921. And I'll tell you what, In my opinion, there are few other subjects as interesting as money, finance, and economics once you figure out the big game here. The game that the Rothschilds in particular are playing with national governments across the globe. There was a lot I wanted to comment on, and I wanted to hold it till the end here. And basically, if you take away nothing else, just remember that you see the Jews control this and they control that. And I want to drive home a point that all of their control flows from the root of their tree of power, so to speak. The root is their control of money creation in the money system, in the central banks. They issue the money, they loan it to our governments at interest, and we can seemingly never pay it back. If you could somehow bar them from the financial world and in the world of money creation, perhaps you may be able to suffocate them from their power. And this should be noted for people in the future. It's sad that more people don't realize this, that the Jews need to be kept out of, well, in the Byzantine sense, out of government, academia, and out of the money world. And if you can do that, perhaps you can put up a counterfight against them and keep them at bay and keep them under control. But you have to absolutely put them in that straitjacket to where they can't mingle and manipulate and get their own way. And just like the protocols point out, they have Gentiles kept in a state of stupor, which the Gentiles are just all too happy to remain in, with the stupid divide and rule and the wanting of the poor Gentiles to soak the rich, so to speak, to tax the rich, as if the doctor down the street in your neighborhood who makes six figures and is taxed at 40 or 50%, depending on the state, that somehow he's the rich person. It's incredibly stupid. It's absurd. But they have the people divided against themselves. They have the goyim divided between Protestant and Catholic, Democrat, Republican, conservative versus liberal. And 90% of our time is wasted fighting each other on these stupid, ridiculous ideas and fights. And it's this cat and mouse game that the Jews perpetuate. Meanwhile, they're the ones behind the scenes controlling everything. They own all the gold. They own the money system. They bribe and control the politicians. They've got it all. And meanwhile, they keep the goyim distracted with these stupid issues like how much should the rich, quote-unquote, pay? Soaking the rich. Pushing this Bolshevik idea. Meanwhile, they know Bolshevism, revolutions, it's only going to get rid of their Gentile competitors, and they're going to use the stupid Gentile Democrats, the Gentile communists, to be the foot soldiers and the cannon fodder and the battering ram to accomplish their aim of getting rid of their Gentile competitors. That's how these people work. And if people don't wake up, and we don't have an increased aware consciousness of how to combat these people instead of the surface level crap line of thinking that we operate in, we're never going to be able to throw up a counterpunch against these people and stop them. One of the founding fathers wrote that a nation which wants to remain free and ignorant won a country that never has been and never will be. One of the major problems, as I see it today, is that people are so busy in the rat race, so busy trying to pay the bills, that they claim or think that they don't have time to learn anything. Now, I've had this thought myself and had this feeling myself plenty of times, trust me. But if people continue putting their heads in the sand, nothing is ever going to change. Nothing's ever going to get better, and you're going to continue to lose. The other problem is that people who get some degree of success and go along with the system and do what they're told with the system, they think that they're going to be on the winning team by going along with the system and screwing everyone else over. And far too many people will think that is success and think that they're special because they work with the system and screwing over everyone else, and that somehow they're smarter and better than everyone else and they're one of the elite. Nothing could be further from the truth. You're just a tool. You're totally expendable. And I hope you do get tossed overboard for working with the enemy. You deserve as much. They know that you've screwed over your own tribe and that at the end of the day, you can't really be trusted. See, they're not stupid and foolish like you are. The ignorance of coin and credit is the downfall of any country, any nation, any civilization. And because we have a populace and a people that refuse to learn, refuse to educate themselves about the nature of the money system and how it works, we have a nation of people that are forever condemned to a life of slavery, wage slavery, that'll never have anything, that'll be born and live their life and work and slave for basically being a renter of their home, their cars, their property, own nothing. Debts outweigh their total assets. And don't get me wrong here, life isn't all about acquiring material possessions. I understand that, but I'm saying they're just so stupid and so used to doing what they want to do and doing what everyone else does and fitting in. And my parents did it this way. My parents were wage slaves and had a mortgage and borrowed money to buy cars and everything else, use credit cards. I'm going to do it this way too. It feels good. I don't have to work hard for it. If people continue in this, we will never again have any modicum of freedom. Like Esau, you have traded it all away for temporary pleasures. Fleeting happiness, fleeting pleasure, luxuries. How much of this, as you guys were listening, did you think, wow, he's talking about today? What about the enticement of the Gentile class for luxuries and all this living beyond your means, living high on the hog, even if you're a poor pauper who makes minimum wage? Don't you understand that can't work and that's destructive? It's like gorging yourself on copious amounts of alcohol and fast food every day. That can't possibly work. It's not possibly sustainable, nor should it be encouraged. People who do not work and do not save and aren't industrious shouldn't have luxury. They don't deserve it. Yet our money system, via credit, via the buy now, pay later syndrome, encourages this. Just like it said in the protocols, we will encourage financial malfeasance and irresponsibility, moral hazard to the Gentile classes. This is exactly what they have done. And people don't care. People don't care that they pay 2.5 or 3 times the initial on paper cost of their house if they can just pay, you know, $800 a month for 30 years. They don't care that they bought a $100,000 house and ended up paying $300,000 at the end of 30 years because, oh, it was a comfortable $800 a month for 30 years and I can get by paying that. I don't have to work hard and save or get a second job or sacrifice on the luxuries of life to have paid for property. People don't care about the true cost of anything. They don't care what it's going to cost them in the long run, just so long as they can make those month-to-month payments. I hope that if you guys follow this through and you're listening to this, I don't know how many people are going to listen to the entire thing. If you haven't listened to the entire thing and you've gotten through this and you've paid attention, you've taken notes, You've tried to listen multiple times. You've gone out and internet searched some of the people and terms mentioned in the series thus far. This is part 40, after all. Congratulations. You've come this far. You've shown yourself worthy to understand things. And the next project is going to be for you to get a copy of the protocols. And there are different versions, just like if you want to read the classics, like The Art of War, there are many different translations, and some are better than others. I would encourage you to search for a version of the protocols in modern English, quote unquote. They kept it simple, and they kept it comprehensible. I have a copy of the protocols from the original that is lengthy, it's laborious to read, and it's very superfluous, extra language and extra complication with the way they write sentences and thoughts that isn't necessary to understand the gist of what they're saying. Get a copy of the protocols in modern English. I think Eric Hufschmid and Daryl Smith put out this particular version I'm talking about more than a decade ago, and it's out there, and I think it's an excellent version. It's very simple to understand. If you want to understand how the Jews operate and the traps that they have set for us, you need to understand the protocols. The protocols of the learned elders of Zion is the Rothschild Jewish game plan for conquest of the Gentile world. And in order to win this war, we need to know our enemy. And to know our enemy, we need to know the protocols. We need to understand what their strategy is. At this particular moment, I don't want to commit to doing the protocols in a series, especially by myself, because it is a lengthy commitment to undertake, and maybe I will, maybe I won't. But you ought to try to do it yourself. I know there are audiobook versions that you can find on YouTube and on MP3 if you do BitTorrent, where you can listen to it just like you're listening to the International Jew here. Maybe listen to it once and try to read it again. Get a print copy, get a paper copy where you can sit down and highlight things and read it multiple times so that it sinks in. That's what it's going to take. I cannot stress this enough. I know everyone enjoys the entertaining alt-right podcast with people bantering back and forth about the latest happenings in the scene. I would say leave that stuff for later. Try to get a solid foundational understanding of these things, like the International Jew, like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, the Rothschild Dynasty. Go get some books on these subjects. We really need to encourage more kind of academic reading and getting down to basics and getting the facts. If you do this and you have a solid education on these matters, you're almost limitless in what you can do. You could go do your own podcast, have your own show, and you will be head and shoulders above most people out there who just focus on the news of today and don't really see how they're being manipulated day by day and don't understand the bigger agenda with news that crosses public consciousness. If you understand these things, you can interpret the news correctly as it should be, as things are truly playing out. Okay, I think I've done enough ranting for this particular episode. I don't want to make it too long. So until next time, guys, praise Christ. God bless you all. Take care. We'll see you next week. Ted Midward signing off for RadioArian.com. Have a good one. Bye-bye.